what occurs to me just sitting here right now is that it's probably a poor introduction to what I'm about to say as a talk, is there was a Japanese Pure Land Buddhist monk who was living in San Francisco in Japantown in the very early 60s. And he was young, he was 23 years old, and he was depressed. And he ran into, in a bookstore, he ran into Suzuki Roshi, who was a Zen teacher up there. And Suzuki Roshi said, "Oh, you should come and sit with me." And so he did, and he started sitting with Suzuki Roshi. And at some point, Suzuki Roshi asked him to give a Dharma talk. "You should talk about the Dharma." He said, "I can't because my English is so poor." And so then, I think maybe the next time Suzuki Roshi was going to give a Dharma talk, that this Reverend Ogui, this Japanese monk, was there. Suzuki Roshi, the story goes, as he tells the story himself, was Suzuki Roshi got up and started walking back and forth across the room here. And he started to say, "Today is today. Today is. Today is not tomorrow. Today is not yesterday. Today is today. Today is." And then he ended the talk and left. And Reverend Ogui counted how many words were in that Dharma talk. And there was a total of 5 words used in various ways. And somehow the way that Suzuki Roshi was able to convey those 5 words had an impact on him. And he realized, oh, you didn't have to know that much English. And you didn't have to say much. Today is today. And, you know, is that profound? And the reason I use this as an introduction to my talk is I have a very, for me, what I think is a very significant topic to bring up to talk about today. But I don't feel like I have much to say about it. So I'll talk about it for a little while, just some of my ideas about this or my relationship to this idea. And then we can just open up and have discussion. Some of you can talk about your relationship to this concept and your thoughts about it, your questions about it. And it's the idea of commitment. And as I was introduced to Buddhist practice through my Zen practice, the idea of commitment was a very important idea, right? Kind of tied together with Buddhist practice, the idea of being committed to practice. And I saw it in many of the people around me when I was first practicing Buddhism. I saw it in my teachers, I saw it in the more senior students around me that I admired. There was a sense of being very strong intention that they were dedicated to, that there was a sense of commitment to, and that they hung in there. And one of the most obvious things I saw was the commitment that people had to sit every day. And they sat day in, day out. They pretty much, they just sat and sat and sat. And it was kind of a feeling of kind of being unwavering. And one of the kind of metaphors, I guess, that was given to me at that time was by a Zen teacher who said, your commitment to sitting every day should be the same as your commitment to brush your teeth every day. It should be that kind of second nature, that easy. You should almost don't think about it. Just, this is what you do. Just, you know, you sit. And part of the value of that commitment, as it was explained to me, was that when you do something that regularly, and it's so second nature, like brushing your teeth, then the specialness of it disappears. And it's just something quite ordinary. And when meditation is quite ordinary, and you're not trying to attain anything or get something from it or trying to make it into something, then the mind actually can relax in a deeper way. But if you're kind of pushing and trying to get something and trying to, you know, then the mind can't really relax in some very deep way that has to happen in order for the practice to take you really far. But if it's just second nature, there's no special deal, no special thing about it, nothing. You're not going to, you're not trying to become the great meditator. And there's nothing in it for you except, prevent cavities. And then it actually can allow the mind to settle in a much, much deeper way. Let go in a deeper way. So you have commitment to just sitting every day. And what I saw around me and in me is that commitment was not easy to something as simple as sitting every day. That there were all this momentum, desires and wishes and aversions and fears that interfered with showing up every day for the simple thing of sitting. And that but because it was the meditation was happening not because of desire, and not because it seems like a good idea, but because of a kind of a commitment that is really meant to be followed, held to. It didn't matter whether people wanted to meditate that day or not, or they liked meditation that day or not, or whether it was a good idea, in many of the categories, many of the ways in which we might evaluate is it a good idea or not. I have a headache. I'm not going to sit there for 45 minutes and feel my headache. That's not a good idea. Or, I have a cold. I don't feel like I have the energy. I need to rest. But to some, within reason, without, being too crazy, the idea was you just sat anyway. You sat and sat and sat with it all. And that sitting with everything allowed a number of things. One thing, to the degree to which the mind rebelled or had other agendas or other ideas, you got to see that really well. And we got to see how the mind has a mind of its own. How the mind pulls us. Come here, follow me, do this. Commands us, demands us. Pushes us with its agendas and ideas and preferences and fears. As opposed to us being in charge. The mind is in charge, or our desires are in charge. And so when there's a commitment, I'm not going to give in to anything, I'm going to do this one thing, then all the ways of the craziness of the mind shows itself, and it's fascinating to see that. It's the beginning of freedom to see that. And because the commitment is right there, you're not going to waver from that commitment, then with time, the mind, the neurotic mind, will begin to relax. It'll let go. It'll just get exhausted. And you give it a chance to get exhausted if you just kind of say, no, I'm not going to go there. I'm not going to go anywhere else but right here. I'm going to do this thing. And eventually it becomes like brushing your teeth and the mind gets settled. The analogy Jack Kornfield likes to use of training a puppy. A more classic analogy, I think, in Buddhism was that of training a horse, where you tie the horse to a stake. And the horse tries to run away, but eventually realizes it can't get away. And then eventually it settles down and goes to sleep. And I saw the idea of commitment with my teachers in my early days of practice, still to this day, they just, not only did they keep showing up to meditate every day, but they just showed up. They were just always there. They were just, seemed like they were always committed to practice, to being there. And a lot of what I learned at the San Francisco Zen Center was the value of just showing up, just being there. Being there to support other people in practice, being there to be a teacher, being there for your meditations, just being there, just showing up. And so there was not a tendency to kind of rush off a lot and be in many other places, and just to be there. And I saw that a lot of the strength and the health of these communities that I practiced in my early years of practice had a lot to do with the commitment people had to just being there, showing up and not being elsewhere, and the kind of community strength of the community arose around it. And then there's things like I saw people who were committed to truth, to being honest, and how inspiring that was to see people being committed to being honest. A real commitment to it. In the Buddhist tradition, there's a range of commitments that people make kind of Buddhist-wise. People, when they first come to Buddhism, sometimes make a commitment to the Triple Refuge, the Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha. And then with that, or sometimes later, they take a commitment to the precepts, living by the precepts, organizing your life by the precepts. And sometimes we don't want to live by the precepts. But sometimes when there's a commitment there, that's what you've promised to do, in a sense. That's what you've vowed to do. I'm going to do this thing. And it's a purification process. It's a mirror to do that. And because there's a commitment, there's a higher standard to hold oneself against than if it's just, you know, a good idea. And then there's, in some schools of Buddhism, there's things like the Bodhisattva vows, which are commitment about how you live your life. The idea of commitment I saw around me being very, very important. I saw that, you know, this is, you know... And I would venture to say that the commitment that people had to their Buddhist practice was what gave power and strength to their meditation practice. That if they didn't have commitment, not only to their commitment to meditation, but their commitment to the other aspects of practice, without that sense of commitment, I don't think that their meditation practice would have been as strong or as powerful or had as much momentum. You know, the analogy for momentum and perseverance in Buddhism is that of lighting fire with two sticks. And if you rub a stick for a while and then go off and have tea, and then come back and rub your stick for a while and then decide it's time to take a nap, and then come back and rub the stick for a while and then decide to go talk with a friend, and then rub a stick for a while and say, well, you know, I don't know if these are good sticks. Maybe I should find some other sticks. And if you keep doing that and interrupting, the stick doesn't get enough friction to create a spark, a flame. And so you have to keep going. Or, you know, boiling water, the same thing. You have to have a continuity of the fire under the water to create it to boil. So the value of commitment is that it gets things boiling within us. It gets the commitment going. Gets the momentum going in the practice. Now, commitment is kind of an interesting word for Buddhists, because commitment has the connotation or has the aspect of being kind of holding on to something. And you'd think that Buddhists aren't going to hold on to anything. But actually, Buddhists do hold on. But they're just not attached. They don't cling. So what's the difference between clinging or being attached to something in a way and having a commitment to something? And I would propose that the important difference is that over time, you'll realize, if you pay attention, that if you're attached to something or clinging to something, that the consequence and how you're feeling will be very different than if you're committed. Clinging leads to further bondage, to further kind of being kind of limited and contracted. And commitment leads to a greater sense of freedom. If commitment doesn't lead to a greater sense of freedom, or doesn't show you that, oh, there is a path here to freedom by dealing with these obstacles, then I don't think it's really very valuable, at least from a Buddhist point of view, to have that kind of commitment. So commitment shouldn't be something that makes you feel less free. It's a very commitment that helps make you free, moves you towards freedom. And I think it's easy enough to see that many people are not free when they're acting freely. Being able to act freely should not be correlated with being free. At least, in America, one of the ideals is to be able to shop freely. You know, and it's our God-given right to shop. And we've built some of the greatest churches of shopping in the world, in America. I've heard there's supposed to be some place in the Midwest, in the Great Mall of America. Is that what it's called? Anybody been there? Have you been there? Is it big? You got lost. And so these great, you know, altars to consumerism. And so, you know, to be able to shop freely, and it's great, right? And people have these little cards that help you do that. And so you could shop freely and freely and freely and then spend the next 20 years dealing with that freedom. And but that kind of freedom is not considered freedom in Buddhism, because what's propelling the freedom is clinging, attachment, craving, and so is that better now? Ooh, a little bit of a and so what Buddhism, what freedom in Buddhism is usually defined not as a freedom to, but freedom from. There, it went off. No. Okay. So we're back on. So freedom, not freedom. So Buddhist notion of freedom is not freedom to do whatever you like, but rather it's freedom from bondage, freedom from the impulses that take us by the nose and pull us along. So it's a freedom from these kind of forces inside of us that keep us from being, from, you know, that tell us and insist that we act and respond in various ways. Freedom from ourselves. So the idea of commitment. I love the word commitment, partly because of etymological root of the word. Apparently, if you look in the dictionary, it means to touch together, to touch with. And I don't know what, I have any idea how the expression to touch with, or that Latin commit, gets to our commitment as touching. But the idea of touching and being tangible, to me, is a very nice idea. And so what is it that commitment touches within us? The movement of commitment. And Rachel Naomi Raymond said somewhere that commitment is a movement of the soul. Not exactly Buddhist vocabulary, but it's this kind of commitment is something of the soul, whereas attachment is something that comes from our kind of, you know, surface impulses of the mind or the brain or something like that. And so the idea of that somehow commitment arises out of some deep touching of something that's really important and valuable within ourselves. And I think what I saw again among the people who I studied with and paid attention to, learned from my early years of practice, I saw that their sense of commitment to practice came because they were touching something that was of great value to them. And because they had this great value and great understanding, they were going to be committed to this. And they saw the value of being committed, of holding to it, come what may. Holding there and just letting things become clarified in the context of that commitment. So the last thing I wanted to say, which again is not so connected, but it occurred to me, it comes from the works of Carlos Castaneda. And he has this, Don Juan apparently at some point says that there are two kinds of people. There's an ordinary people who see their life either through the categories of blessing or curses. Things that occur either blessings or curses for them. That's the ordinary person. And the warrior, which is kind of what Don Juan's into, right? The warrior sees everything as a challenge. I know there's a great difference, right? You see things either as a blessing or a curse, or you see things as a challenge. And I think the idea of Buddhist practice is much more the idea of seeing things as a challenge, whether things are happening or as a blessing that are happening to you, or things are as a curse to you, difficult. Whatever it might be, it's all then fuel and food to keep working on our practice, to keep showing up, keep being mindful, keep the commitment, the practice in the forefront. So for mindfulness students, one of the primary commitments is mindfulness itself. and to be committed to being mindful, to being aware of what's happening now, the inner world and the outer world. And the commitment to being mindful means that the mind stays fluid, stays free with what is happening. The commitment to pay attention to what's happening now, as opposed to getting caught up in what just happened. So if someone comes in, to the meditation hall late and bangs the door and knocks over a few chairs on the way in, one option is to see that as a curse or a blessing or something, and then start thinking about how these kinds of people should never be allowed in the meditation hall, and we should probably post guards at the door or video cameras with television screen here, so it's kind of like public, outing of them, so everybody knows who that person is. And whatever, the mind starts going, the way the mind does. The mind has lost its commitment to mindfulness if it gets carried down those kinds of ways. But rather, the commitment is, what's happening now? What's happening now? What's happening now? Let's look at this more deeply. What is this experience I'm having right now? Let's let go of the blame and the judgments about that thing. Let's really be here with what's actually happening here, inner and outer. Let's keep looking. Let's keep looking. Let's keep looking. So the commitment in mindfulness practice is always this very simple thing of just looking, or being aware. What's happening now? What's happening now? And it takes a tremendous commitment, or if you prefer, tremendous trust in the practice to keep it going moment by moment, that you're willing, in some sense, to let go of any kind of holding on to what just happened. And to be willing to move into the next moment, as interested in the next moment, as in a fresh way. What's this? And you keep this. That's the commitment in mindfulness practice. Just, what is this? And I guess this is hopefully the last time I'll say this, is the last thing I'll say. One of the notions that I saw in my early years also among my Zen teachers and fellow students was, not everyone talked about this, but I had this notion was kind of in the air of, it's a kind of ideal, maybe if I say it, you'll hear it the wrong way. So when you hear it, kind of interpret it in the best terms, the best possible ways you can. But the idea of having a dumb commitment, being really dumb, or dumb commitment, a stupid commitment. The commitment isn't stupid, but the way you hold it, you're just dumb or stupid to it. I mean, you just do it, and you just hold on to it. You know, something's really stupid. Just, you don't have any better idea or any better sense, and just be stupid with your commitment. And that's good, within reason. And so commitment is very important, and it's a lovely thing. And if you prefer, there's other words you could use. I also like the word dedication, to be dedicated. Some people feel that's more heartfelt. They'll have a firm dedication. I suspect that Buddhist practice doesn't really work for people unless there's commitment as part of it. So now I've talked long enough. So what are your thoughts about this topic, your experiences and challenges with commitment? Yes?
It reminds me of a story of this naval, the person who was in the Navy, who's home, and he was discharged because he was lost from an injury. So he started embarking on traveling, and the only way he can see is when people would have him touch them. So instead of looking at this as a curse, this blindness that he had, he was able to feel more. He had this commitment to travel, this sort of mindfulness way of traveling. And he just touched things, and people hadn't touched them. And the idea was that if you don't touch me, if you don't make a commitment to it, then you risk not being touched.
Hmm. That's beautiful. Very nice. So you won't be touched yourself unless you touch. So it's a come touching, touching with.
Yeah. And a grounder for me is, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of other people here who bring friends or family over time, I've probably brought a dozen people over the last year, is they like the idea of meditation. And I enjoy bringing them, and there's no judgment if they don't come back, or maybe they don't come back for 4 months or 3 months. But it's a benchmark for me in terms of my commitment, that I can see in relationship to someone else who's not willing to put the time in. So it's sort of an affirmation for me to continue on the practice.
Great. Right. Thank you.
You know, thinking about it, commitment is the essence of the practice. Because I haven't developed the skill to be in a mindful space all the time. And I haven't developed the skill to be in a compassionate space all the time. So the only thing I can really do is to make a commitment to those things. And that is the practice. The practice isn't what it, I mean, the doing those things come from the commitment, so without the commitment, nothing happens.
Uh-huh. Yeah. The I like the distinction, I like to distinguish a commitment from a promise. Because a promise, you don't want to break. But a commitment is okay, you don't want to, it's not really a matter of breaking a commitment, at least, you know, I guess some commitments are kind of like promises, but a commitment is a kind of an intention to align oneself with certain values or intention to live a certain way or to practice a certain way. And so we do our best to follow that intention, but there's no sense that, you know, you're going to be perfect at it. You need the commitment because you're not perfect. But to promise, you know, you kind of like, you know, I promise to sit every day, and you break your promise, that feels kind of weird, doesn't it?
Somebody else, a commitment to yourself, in a
promises to other people and commitment to oneself.
Because if you, you know, you're not really, if your intention is to sit every day and you don't one day, what are you, you know, going to bang yourself on the head about it? You know, that's part of the mindfulness.
Yeah.
Set the time aside, sit. Some days you don't sit. No, you still sit when it's time.
Yes.
I'm glad you said that because I think sometimes that's part of my challenge. My personal one is I feel like I see the commitment more in black and white. I have a tendency to slip into that.
Uh-huh.
So that if I don't follow through with sitting regularly, I feel like falling off. And okay, my commitment's broken. Now I need to reestablish it at some point. So if I won't be now, reestablish it later. Or you know, and then get back on. I feel like when I start to mess, that the commitment's broken. And I like the distinction that you're talking about, that it's not commitment's broken. I look at it more as a promise, and actually I think is a hindrance for me to continue being committed.
Uh-huh.
So I look forward to finding it not the best way for myself.
Thank you. Yes.
Do you see a connection between commitment to the mindfulness, to the present moment, and renunciation of other things?
Is there a connection between commitment to the present moment, being mindful to the present moment, and renunciation of things or other things?
Like thoughts, like the thoughts about what has already happened or what's going on.
There are times when it's unless there's some kind of letting go of something, you're not going to show up and be mindful of the present moment.
I know that one, yes. I have the global commitment, but then when it comes to like sitting in meditation, it's requiring a lot of renunciation of thoughts that seem kind of delicious or compelling.
So it seems like sometimes mindfulness requires a lot of renunciation of certain kinds of thoughts that seem very delicious and very compelling. And it can sometimes, you know, sometimes there is a letting go of things, sometimes thoughts or different momentums of the mind or whatever. And it can be a very important part of practice to learn to let go and let go and let go. But I think at the heart, it's not really a matter of letting go of anything that's necessary. If the mindfulness is very, very keen, it's not really required. You don't necessarily let go of a thought. What you let go of is the way that you're relating to that thought. And so the thought does what it does, but you're no longer clinging to the thought or fascinated by the thought or interested in thought. It's the relationship we have with the thought which we let go of rather than the thought itself. Because that's really the problem. Thoughts are pretty innocent. You know, they're just these innocent things that float by. But it's the way we relate to them. And sometimes in meditation circles, thoughts get a bad rep. It's really not their, you know, unfair to blame them for all they get blamed for. Yes?
You mean there's a problem with the word renunciation because it sounds a little too actively rejecting letting go. So, to say that you renounce thinking about other things, I think that makes me feel a little squirmy because it just sounds too much like pushing away.
I think, again, the
connotations for me.
It makes sense that some people would have a kind of connotation with it. And I think, again, in the Buddhist situation, you don't want to necessarily measure a concept by how it sounds to us, but rather when we live by that concept, what are the consequences for us? So if, in fact, renunciation for you, the movement to what you call renunciation, causes you to be more aversive or more afraid or more, you know, something which is unhealthy, then that's not a good movement for you. But if renunciation leads to a greater freedom, greater lightness, greater happiness, then it's probably something which is really good to do. We renounce things all the time. I mean, when I get home, I have to take out the trash. I'm happy to let go of it. Yes.
I like what you said about speed of commitment or dollar commitment, and I think that taking that approach, then there's no reason. The reasons are irrelevant because there's a million reasons to not do something. Like this panel, I'm going to put my son every morning. I don't want to go to school. Why do I have to go to school? Every day, just push it up. But the answer comes. Just push it up. And so there's no reason.
One of the places where the value or of commitment or a certain way commitment works shows itself is for parents with their children or with other people, caretaking elderly parents or friends or neighbors who are sick or something. And, you know, there's a kind of a sense of commitment. You maybe haven't made some serious commitment. I'm committed to these people, you know, but these people are sick or something, you know, whatever, and you get up in the middle of the night and then they throw up all over you and this and that, and you know it's kind of a drag because, you know, you get tired the next day, but you're going to be there, and you don't question whether you're going to be there or not when this person is throwing up all over, that's what you do. You're there. And it's something very valuable to be learned from that kind of commitment, because it's kind of when we step aside, our own desires and preferences step aside for something that needs to happen. And when we can do that freely, I think that's a really important movement of freedom. And it's kind of a commitment. Like parents are committed to their kids, or children are committed to their elderly parents as they're, you know, getting sick and frail. And, you know, it overrides our self-concern sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering if commitment habits. You know, something about brushing my teeth, going to the dentist or something. I found out lots of things that I was doing wrong with my teeth. Doing the best job that I can do, maintaining my teeth that I could. And I think similarly in meditation, I can get in these phases of just being sort of dull with my discipline and not really coming back and gazing out for longer periods of time. So I find there's some other quality of intention or mindfulness as opposed to just sitting that needs to be there for it to be of deeper benefit.
Yes. I agree. I mean, as I've sometimes said in the circles, that quoting Ajahn Sumedho, if sitting long periods of time is what it took, chickens would be enlightened. So certainly we need more, you know, more than just a commitment to show up, to sit there. I agree. So then there's, you know, certainly a lot of discernment and that goes into, you know, knowing the, you know, meditation equivalent of exactly how to floss. But you have to be, the commitment to floss every day has to be there.
That's right.
And then you refine it. Mark, the dentist.
Being a dentist. The thing about, like, in my life, for all the reasons that brought about my commitment to practice, my personal experience, my inner experience, all those things. One of the interesting things is that lately, I don't go around with people who are basically meditators. My family has other practices, and my friends, you know, are into it a little bit, but not really, you know, daily practitioners. But another thing I'm getting feedback now is how much they're influenced by my practice without being aware of it. When I think about it, people who really influence me are people with great commitment. Their practice, and somehow that practice is really radiated and influenced. And I think that part of developing a practice with commitment, that you're doing it not just for yourself, but you're doing it, you know, through community, sadhana, people who might not be sitting all the time. So it's surprising how that reflects back.
That's nice. It reminds me of this, when I was a college student. I lived in a communal household of 5-6 of us. And I sat every day, for 2 times a day. In the morning, I first got up for 40 minutes. And then I think somewhere around 8:30, 9 o'clock in the evening, I'd sit again. But it was very regular, every evening, except for Sundays, every evening and every morning. And I just did it. You know, I just did it. You know, I didn't think about it too much. I just did it every day except Sunday. And then several years later, after we had a household that had disbanded, one of the roommates said, you know, I lived in the house for a year, and then I moved on, and the household continued for a while. And they said, when you left, it became chaos in the house. Your regularity of sitting, because you were so regular, it created kind of the structure for the house when you were there. And everybody kind of went to bed early then, and kind of settled everything out and whatever. And when you weren't there sitting, I just went to my room and meditated, closed my door and sat. But somehow that, you know, it spilled over beyond the door. And well, you see, I was introduced to Zen meditation at the San Francisco Zen Center. And the schedule there was they sat every day but Sunday. They still do. They don't sit on Sunday except, you know, when they have retreats. What? I don't know why. They just, I don't know why they, you know, just, I never questioned it. They just, that's what, you know, and I thought, well, that's probably a good idea. I don't know. So I just thought it was a good idea, and I thought, vaguely in my mind, it's similar, you know, you don't want to be too fanatic about this. And somehow the psyche kind of gets, you know, just a little bit of space, and I don't know. Just so I sat sitting 2 periods a day is, you know, fairly serious. And I did it every day, but not on Sunday. No. So, last one, then we'll stop.
I guess I've definitely had a very kind of clear experience about this feeling of commitments as freeing. I decided to become vegan for a while this around New Year's. And a lot of people, when they hear about it, think, you know, oh, it sounds so strict, or, you know, they pick up some kind of sense of restraint and confinement. And I've just really had a strong sense of being free from a lot of things. There's just so many unhealthy foods that don't, I just don't look at it. They're just, I don't eat that kind of stuff. And I was on a ski trip in Austria, and one day they had this whole big dessert buffet thing for dessert. And I looked around, asked the waitress, is there anything here that doesn't have cream? She said, well, there's this jar of fruit. And that's all. I don't know. I feel much freer from it.
So many people, Buddhists, will talk about also the freedom that comes from renunciation. That renunciation can give a tremendous sense of lightness of being and freedom and commitment like this also. So thank you so much. This was lovely. And I hope that this topic has, you know, interesting for you, or kind of prompts you to think more deeply about it and how it might be useful in your life. And I hope you have a wonderful month and a committed month. And I will be back here on Mondays at the end of the month, of March. Thank you.